This is Guy McPherson, and I'm going to be having a conversation with him today about climate change and everything related.
Thanks, Dylan Thompson. I'm looking forward to this relatively brief and informal conversation.
As am I. I wanted to talk to you about your work and the work of other climate scientists, especially those who, like yourself, are not really holding anything back in telling it like it is, basically, and how bad it is. And there are many canaries in this coal mine, whether they be noctilucent clouds, whether they be, you know, the storms, the droughts, the lack of rain, the ice calving from the Arctic. Why are people not hearing the canaries? What are the forces at work here?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. This entire culture, as you know, is insane.
Yeah.
And part of that insanity is blocking those messages. Part of that insanity is telling us we can have infinite growth on a finite planet with no adverse consequences. And we capitulate to that every time we use green pieces of paper to pay for coffee or whatever. And so at some level, the whole thing provides us enormous privilege.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't really want to hear the bad news associated with it. I think that's probably a huge part of it.
Right.
You know, that's the interpersonal side, as well as the corporate media hammering us with the messages side, and the government's going along.
Right.
It's really hard to be the person who wants to dig deeper and find out that, you know, imperialism has its costs.
Mm-hmm.
Who'd have thunk it?
Right.
Right. So for some people, once they make that discovery, that the admission that this is an empire, and that imperialism means murdering a lot of people and destroying every aspect of the planet and obedience at home, that changes their entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're living a life of privilege, as most of us are in the global north, maybe you just don't want that to happen.
Right. Yeah, and I was just reading something talking about the green pieces of paper. A report about, you know, the energy industry, the global energy industry would have to leave in the ground something along the lines of $2 trillion, you know, worth of remaining fossil fuel that are in the ground. And that's $2 trillion. And you're going to, I'm not sure what we're going to try to do, convince them with moral persuasion and, you know, pictures of what climate change is going to look like. Well, I mean, that should change behavior, but $2 trillion in the short term is
absolutely,
is just too much to turn the train around, it seems.
Right. And, you know, I think that's really the bottom line,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, we're products of evolution by natural selection, so that means we're flight or fight organisms from the get-go.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to think over relatively short periods of time,
right,
like whether we're going to eat next week.
Right.
And then there's the corporate cultural message of money being the all-important end-all and be-all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, what would you expect?
Right. Right.
I think the bottom line, at least the way I've been saying it for a few years, is when greed is your only god, sociopaths assume control.
Mm-hmm.
And we just chase the money and
yeah,
stay on that hamster wheel.
Yeah.
It plays right into the sociopathy of this
mm-hmm.
culture.
Sociopaths are rewarded.
Absolutely.
In this culture. Well, another thing I wanted to...
It makes me want to be one.
Right. Right. Well,
there's
so much for you if you are a sociopath. Given the freight train, given the momentum, and given the extremely short amount of time it seems that we have, you know, what does sanity look like? What is the opposite end of the spectrum? For those of us who don't want to be sociopaths and don't want to have anything to do with that app, you know, what do we do? And as you know, I'm myself and the people I work with are of the mind that undermining this system is pretty much the only thing that humans can do at this point. But the other side of that you know, is perhaps helping the Earth to heal in whatever ways it can. And what I wanted to ask you was, climatologists are constantly coming into contact with feedback loops that they weren't necessarily aware of. They didn't know that it was going to be this bad because this particular feedback loop was all of a sudden makes itself known. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because of the emergent nature of the Earth. And we're just small creatures. We can't
right.
We can't know. And so I'm
and you don't even know that a feedback loop has been triggered until it's in the rearview mirror.
Right.
It was all
hindsight.
Very theoretical and abstract up
yeah.
until that point. Sure.
And I'm wondering about the flip side of that, because there's some really exciting research being done and practice being done on prairie restoration and on forest restoration, and people didn't know about the ability of intact perennial polyculture ecosystems to sequester carbon. And so I'm wondering if feedback loops can go the other way as well in the Earth's healing.
Of course they can.
Yeah.
And they have many times throughout Earth's history.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at 500 million years of the last 500 million years of planetary history, you see two states that are stable over very long periods of time, tens of millions of years. And it's ice age and about 10 degrees centigrade above ice mm-hmm. age. And really very few stable states between those two, and not very stable, as in happened once or twice
right.
in that entire 500 million years. So really there's hothouse Earth and there's ice age Earth, and there's very little stepwise action in between.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't know what many of those negative feedbacks are. We don't know what causes Earth to go from hothouse to ice age, frequently in a very short period of time.
Right.
So there must be these self-reinforcing feedback loops that cause the thing to get cooler as it gets cooler as
right.
well.
Right.
We don't understand much about that.
Mm-hmm.
But they must exist,
yeah.
or we would have gone Venus a long time ago,
mm-hmm.
you know, upon reaching this hothouse state, or
yeah.
just stayed at the Jurassic Park sort of temperature at the,
right.
at the global average.
Right.
Of course, the entire predicament, like so many of our predicaments, is rooted in industrial civilization, so I absolutely agree with you, Deep Green Resistance, Idle No More, and a bunch of others, that if you're going to turn off the heat and turn off all the other predicaments associated with civilization, then you have to turn the civilization off.
Right.
You have to undermine it.
Right.
So I'm a big fan of that.
Yeah.
Even if it does mean that we go extinct, because we're driving ourselves to extinction already.
Right. Yeah. So what is to lose, you know,
right.
by taking that path.
Right.
And it's just so interesting to me that in conversation with, you know, children will sometimes give you a more reasonable and honest, you know, answer as to what we should do about this situation than your academic, your typical academic, or your person working for some eco-friendly consulting firm somewhere, you know. And that's been a frustrating thing for me, trying to work with people my age, people older than myself. There aren't a lot of people out there willing to look at it. Not that I blame them, because
right.
we're talking about the end of life, you know.
Well,
so.
And before that, the end of enormous privilege.
Right.
So,
right.
And it took me a long time to figure out why young people and millennials, you know, the truly younger set, got this.
Mm-hmm.
And we go skipping across the presentation hall
mm-hmm.
after I spoke, completely liberated.
Right.
And on the other extreme were people my age and older who have been stuck in the rut for a long time. They can't see their way out of the rut.
Mm-hmm.
So they're devastated mm-hmm. that their privilege might go away.
Yeah.
So I think the very young, you know, Albert Einstein said something about children and scientists sharing a similar outlook on the world. Well, I think you'd be appalled at what most scientists have become.
Right.
Most academic scientists.
Right.
At any rate.
Yeah.
Because they don't, it's not about the curious and passionate pursuit of knowledge regardless of the consequences anymore.
Yeah. What I often think about is how to conduct myself moving forward in this. And the question that keeps haunting me is, you know, what's the point? You know, what's the point of being in an organization, for instance, that might get me in trouble in a big way, thrown in prison, killed, whatever. And I go back to that sort of emergent aspect of the world. You know, it's one thing that gives me more hope than anything is, let's say you're sitting in a room looking at a window and the rain is coming down and you have water droplets going down the window. The most advanced scientific instrumentation can't predict which way that water droplet is going to fall.
Right.
Nor can you predict the next micro moment of the next human heartbeat. That wildness, that giant force that is in us, around us, everywhere, is what gives me hope, because then if our small actions as humans might be able to undermine this system, maybe, just maybe, that wild force will start the healing process in an exponential way, and who knows? I absolutely agree.
Yeah. And furthermore, I've relatively recently become aware that one of the principles of Buddhism is right action, or doing what you believe is the right thing, independent of the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think that's important, because we've been trying for a long time, you and I, and many other people, to live differently than this culture screams at us to live. And it's not changing the outcome.
Right.
But pursuing a different path is its own reward.
Yeah.
And we must do it regardless of the outcome.
Yes.
Because it's the right thing to do.
Yeah. I'm in full agreement. I think that's all we have time for today, but I appreciate your willingness.
Thank you,
Guy.